Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
In a trance, you fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street.
Our guest, college professor and attorney Kenneth King, spent over a year opposing the effects of the Department of Homeland Security, listen to it closely, to bring the country's second largest biodefense facility to his South Central Kentucky community. He's the author of Germs Gone Wild, that's his expose, of the bioweapons, bioterrorism, biodefense industry. And let's say, Kenneth, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and by the way, thank you so much for being here. This is an area that most people, I'm going to say most of us, I have no idea either. Most of us have no idea what's going on. There's a movie, obviously, Contagion, why the U.S. research could cause the pandemic scenario from the movie Contagion. So, Kenneth, let's start at base. What are we dealing with? And if we're not careful, what goes out of control?
Well, first of all, there are two huge elements of this. One is there has been a huge increase in new high-risk germ labs in the U.S. since 2001. These are labs studying diseases for which there is no cure or effective treatment, like the fictional virus in Contagion, or diseases that will kill you or are likely to kill you if you don't get treatment quickly. The numbers rose from something like 200 in 2001 to over 1,400 at this point. Accidents occur regularly. There have been huge numbers of new researchers who came in with their training shortcutted. The accidents are usually concealed from the public. And the labs, many of them are engaged in some very reckless research.
Okay, let me ask you this. Where does the money come from for these labs? You know, it's the old adage, if you want to find out where the problem is you've got to follow the money. Who actually, when I say is behind it, who has the opportunity to make an income, to make some kind of a profit off of these labs?
Okay, well, the only profit that is being made is by and large from government grants that are funding the labs. There are over a dozen different agencies that are involved in biodefense or hazardous pathogen research, and they've all been on a spending spree because the government dumped about $70 billion into biodefense after 2001. And it's a huge pork barrel and a lot of incentive to spin the problem and make it appear probably worse than it is.
Okay, there's your follow the money, realistically, when it comes down to it. And making that problem worse than it is obviously keeps people fearful, and that's what controls us. There's no question about that. So in essence, you know why. You can't be the only person that knows there's a problem here. Other people know there's a problem. Where do you start to get this stopped?
Well, first is to make people aware of the problem. I don't think many people, indeed, are aware of the problem. For the most part, people only become aware of the problem if a new facility is going up in their midst and if there are local people who investigate a little bit into the situation. Otherwise, most of the government and media spin the dangers of bioterrorism when, in fact, probably the more significant danger is arising from the labs themselves. I need to speak about one particularly dangerous thing which has happened, and that is that government scientists at the CDC, University of Wisconsin, and most recently Rotterdam University, have, using funding provided by the U.S. government, deliberately created forms of the bird flu that spread directly between human beings. Now, to put this in perspective, so far there have been about 600 people around the world who died from bird flu. They all got bird flu from close contact with infected poultry. They have now created forms of the bird flu that can spread directly between human beings, they believe. They have done this research not at the highest level of containment, BSL-4, that's used for Ebola and smallpox research, but at BSL-3, and there are over 1,300 of those labs in the U.S. And all it will take is one infected researcher taking that infection out into the general public, and we could have a pandemic that could kill half of the planet.
Okay, but let me back this up for a moment, because obviously what you're saying, you've researched it, you know what you're talking about here, and a lot of it is obvious. You know, they create the disease in the lab supposedly to be able to control it and so on and so forth, and from what you've just said, they're not really doing the best job at all in controlling, and you've got people there, stop me if I'm wrong, this is what I heard, who really don't have the expertise or the wherewithal to deal with the real problems that the possibility of that possibly exist. So in essence, what you're really saying is it's our tax money, we are dumping billions of dollars into research that in effect could come back and bite us, because we're not putting the safety stops in to be able to protect ourselves from the very things that we're creating.
Yes. Well, first of all, the Government Accountability Office, after some high-profile accidents in 2007, looked into this situation and said government safety regulation was so minimal that the labs were essentially regulating themselves, and very little has changed since 2007. And then you have the other side of this, which is researchers, I guess, being overconfident and believing that they have state-of-the-art equipment and such that will protect them from being infected by the diseases. But there have been several high-profile incidents over the last several years of researchers being infected by the diseases they were studying and walking around sick in the public for weeks, in one case months, before the disease was correctly diagnosed. Now, these happen to be diseases like Brucella and tularemia that don't transmit easily between human beings. If this happens even one time with this new killer bird flu that they have created, then we have that pandemic on our hands.
Okay, I want to go... Yeah, Ken, let me stop you just
go
for
ahead.
A second.
I was just going to tell you that the New York Times just discovered this bird flu research the end of December and 1st of January, NPR, NBC. I wrote about it over a year ago in my book, 2010. I warned about the first stage of this research. And their arguments are essentially the ones that I have. It's highly questionable whether this research should have been done at all. If it were going to be done, it should have been done at the highest level of containment. Let me explain what that means. There are about 15 to 18 BSL-4 labs in the country, whereas there are over 1,300 BSL-3 labs, a huge number of those at American universities in almost every state. So we could be dumping this very dangerous virus to all kinds of places.
No, absolutely. And there's something in your press release I want to bring up, because I think it's a major, major key issue here. You know, the defending us from ourselves after the anthrax attacks of 2001, which the FBI says were perpetrated by a mentally unbalanced U.S. biodefense researcher. The government began funding hundreds of new high-risk biodefense labs around the country. This one element, this one factor that you can add to the mix here, is one unbalanced researcher can destroy everything, and we have them out there. It'll go back to Fort Hood, go back to wherever you want to go. There's usually somebody in there that's got their mind in a different place, and the destruction of who we are is what drives them. And I think this is a key point, and these people who do the research Are they vetted? What do they have to go through before they're allowed into these labs to work on such dangerous material?
There is a security clearance process, but it's not very strong. Dr. Richard E. Bright, director of the Waxman Institute of Microbiology at Rutgers University and a prominent critic of this biodefense hysteria, says the security process needs to be much more stringent than it is. If you're going to work with bioweapons agents, if you want to work on ordinary public health diseases, you probably shouldn't have to go through something this dangerous. Now, we're talking about not things like this killer bird flu that they just created. The real irony here is that the attacks came from an unbalanced researcher, so you would have thought the emphasis would have been on tightening up security and maybe limiting the number of people who had access to these bioweapons agents. Instead, we've gone entirely the other direction, and a very dangerous situation.
Oh, sure. And I had mentioned fear early on. If you listen to all of the media messages, you're going to be driven by fear for who you're going to vote for. You're going to be driven by fear how to look at the world and the culture and what to stand up against. I mean, this list goes on. And one of the things that that you mentioned in your press release, too, is also obsession. The obsession we've had with the defense and the money that we throw into things because we're frightened to death that something might happen, and we end up, again, biting ourselves with it.
Yes, I hate to point out, but probably the worst thing that was done for biodefense and public health in general was the invasion of Iraq, where $3 trillion was spent. And now we don't have money to cover basic public health needs. There is consideration being given to scrapping the Medicare system. And if there even were a bioterror attack, what's going to have to deal with that is the public health infrastructure. And I'm afraid the money is not going to be there for that. One, because of all of this money that was spent in this particular war, which was partly driven by false claims of weapons of mass destruction being located in Iraq. Some of the same people who raised the fear factor at that point are continuing to raise it now and saying, well, we need to spend more and more money on biodefense research. But if they hadn't spent all of that $3 trillion in the first place, maybe there would be more money for where it's really needed.
Well, I don't know. We're spending so much money right now, Kenneth. I don't know if there would be any more money or not.
It's hard to keep track of it all, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you come down to it, you know, if they're going to do Medicare cuts, et cetera, if you look at the statistics, you know, when you take a look at what's going to happen in 2020, 2035, you know, you got all these baby boomers that are starting to come of age and their kids. You're talking about hundreds of millions of seniors that are going to be on Social Security, Medicare, and so on and so forth. So we've got a tremendous amount of things that we have to look at. And one of the things, which you're talking about, is to be able to protect ourselves, quote unquote, from ourselves. And this ability to spend money, to be pushed to spend money in areas that aren't that necessary, some way, shape, or form, has got to stop. Left side of the aisle, right side of the aisle, I don't think it matters at this point. We need some very logical, consistent thinking to be able to protect us from this. What you're bringing up now, there should be somebody in the current administration, and if it was the past administration, I'd be saying the same thing, that is taking a look at this and the consequence for the actions that have been taken. What's going on here? And if you've got something this dangerous and you don't have safety incorporated into a safety structure incorporated into this, something's wrong somewhere, and somebody from the administration should get in there and get it either stopped or checked.
I fully agree.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter what administration. I think that's really what we're dealing with.
I will say on this particular area, both administrations have been pretty much equally culpable, with the slight exception that I blame Bush for the Iraq invasion, but I blame Obama for not getting out of it quickly enough.
Okay, yeah, and I hear you loud and clear. And I really believe what we are dealing with now is pure politics. I think they've gotten off track, and your topic in your book, Germs Gone Wild, fall into that space whereby somebody overlooked something, somebody turned their back, and money got dumped into something. And then there's so many, many things. Yeah, go ahead.
One of the problems is that many politicians are soliciting these facilities for their districts and such. So they're driven by economic concerns. And and I cover a lot of the political things in my book, including there is an appearance by two Republican candidates, Mitt Romney and Rick Perry, both have involvements in here, and there are Democratic people that have involvements of a negative nature and a couple of a very positive nature as well.
It would be wonderful if we didn't have to see that. But again, both sides of the aisle are getting the same thing. Somebody is going to get voted for based on, I'm going to call it pork barrel, for their constituency. And that's realistically what all of this stuff has turned into, at the expense, the possible cost of life of the people in this country.
Yes, my experience in reviewing these situations around the country involving the facilities has been that the very influential people who have the companies that might make a profit from being involved in the construction or staffing of the facilities are in favor of it, and the ordinary citizens are usually very concerned and skeptical, but they're usually pushed aside in most of these struggles, not in every case, fortunately.
I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Kenneth, do you have a website we can find you at? Where can we find the book and get more information?
Okay, www.germsgonewild.com, and there's a huge amount of information there. And people can also click on a tab and get a free list of accidents that are discussed in the book, broken down by state and all of that. All they need to do for that is enter their email. And there are places to buy the book there on the website as well.
Okay, one quick question before we go. What do I, as the average citizen here, what can I do about this?
Okay, the first thing is to become informed and then just to spread the word some. And then you certainly can write your congressman about this bird flu situation. I think most of Congress is not aware of this situation. They're in the habit of saying, oh, we need to give our scientists the resources to defend us from bioterrorism. And what we've got is a really Wild West situation out there that needs to be brought under control.
Got it loud and clear. Hey, Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Okay. Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
some of these days you're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Vonda White with us. Very successful entrepreneur. She's a speaker. She's an author. And her drive and professional accomplishments have earned her many, many honors, including the Tampa Bay Business Journal Distinguished Woman in Business Award, the induction into the Pinellas County Business Women's Hall of Fame. She is the author of, listen to it close, Success Against the Odds. And let's say, Vonda, I welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about success against the odds, in today's world especially, that just the title in and of itself really tells a story, doesn't it?
I think so. And it fits pretty much anybody, because we all have odds to overcome and obstacles. And instead of giving up and keeping down when things knock us down, we learn to pick ourselves up and move forward, because you never know how close you are to success if you quit.
No, well, I'm not going to tell you this, but back in the 50s when I was growing up, you didn't hear that. Back in the 50s when I was growing up, we got taught that. You got knocked down, you got up, you kept moving. You got knocked down, you learned a lesson, and you went out and you did as the best you could. You got into sports. You lost the game. No, you didn't. You won, and you won because you played, but the next time you had to be better so you could get the first spot. Those are things that we were automatically taught in a world that doesn't even exist anymore. In today's world, it's not quite like that. And I believe with a book like you have, the information that you have, the way that you look at things, really needs that message to be gotten out today, because there's so many people who don't live their life that way and they get lost.
Right. I agree with you.
What was it that caused you? What sparked you to write this book in the first place?
Well, I had grown up in a single-parent family household where my mom was raising three kids, and we were on food stamps and welfare most of my life while I was growing up. And I never would have imagined I'd be in the place that I am today, where I own my own company, and I wanted to be able to write a book in order to help people realize that they can accomplish their goals and dreams, and it is accessible if you follow a procedure, which is what I started doing from my teens on, and it helped me to achieve things along the way that I never would have thought I could have, and that could have happened to me. And so it's really just following these practices and implementing them in your life, and then using it from, you know, from whatever age you start until the end, because every year we can always improve, we can always have goals and dreams and be pursuing things to improve our own life, whether it's a business or professional or personal part of our life.
Now, as a practical example, because, you know, one of the things that you do deal with, which I think is extremely important, is the power of written goals. All right, now, the key here is this. You get somebody who can't really stay with it, falls down and then go hides in a corner. How is the written goal going to help? When you start out on your search for something, your venture for something, what's the power of the goal? And when I say what's the power of the goal, if I want to use it, how do I practically put it in my hands and make it manageable and something real for me?
With a written goal, I created a success planner to where I have people put their dream sheet for 1 to 15 years and then your one-year goals and the action steps you're going to take to accomplish those goals. So everything is in one place, and it's basically a calendar system, but all your goals and dreams and things that you're working on is all in one location. The importance of that is you not only have your written goals, but you're looking at them on a daily basis. And so you don't forget what is it that I'm trying to accomplish, because the majority of people, only 3% of the population, have written goals. Other people have goals, but they usually don't know where they are. They couldn't just automatically list them off for you and tell you, yes, these are ones that I'm working on every day, you know, or at least once or twice a week, every day, every week, every month. And a lot of times people have goals, but they don't even remember what they are. And so they're really not goals, because if it's a goal and it's written, it's in front of you, you have a plan, you know how you're going to accomplish that goal, what you need to do action step-wise to get things done so that you get closer and closer to the goal every week.
So it just keeps you on track and allows you to focus then.
Right. And it also gives you a game plan, basically, where when we don't have a map, we might get there, but we take shortcuts or long cuts because we get lost and we're going in circles, and then we get misguided and forget what we're doing, and something else comes up, so we're focusing our attention elsewhere. But when you have written goals, you're focused and you're working on things like a laser, trying to get these things that are really a priority with you taken care of.
Okay, one of the most important things that I'm seeing here, I have your press release in front of me, and the best way to regroup, to rebuild through the tough times. There are so many people who have something great. It's innovative, it's creative, and they're ready to rock with it, and somehow they get knocked down, and they don't know how to get back up and regroup and go back after it again.
Right, and you know, with this economy, a lot of people have had hard knocks, and then also there's a lot of uncertainty and questions where you're not sure where your business is going or your life or maybe your career or your job. And with good goals, at least you know, okay, I'm going to put 100% forward on this, and if it doesn't work out, maybe you have a plan B that you're working on, but you're working instead of just kind of being like a yo-yo where you allow the punches to come and you swing with them, but it knocks the wind out of you, basically. Where when you're goal-oriented, it keeps you more positive, you're focused, you're working on bettering yourself in many ways so that you can be the best that you can be, both personally and professionally.
Okay, there's a couple of things to take into consideration, and especially in today's world, not as much as it was, quote-unquote, yesteryear. Today, the goal setting, you have to take into consideration the culture, the mix of the culture that we were dealing with, also the political wind at the time that you start this. There are so many variables that somebody is up against when they go into business for themselves today that if they don't know, they don't really know how to deal with. I think most people get in trouble. It's not what they don't know, it's what they don't know that they don't know. So you take somebody like yourself who's created what you've created, it's a way to hold somebody by the hand and lead them through and to give them what they didn't know. You can't learn what you've got here in high school or, for the most part, in college. You can get academic wisdom, but what happens when you get out into the real world to use it doesn't always work that well. So I take that back. I say academics without the word wisdom. It's the wisdom that comes from being out there and doing it and running into all the hard knocks. So if you take somebody like yourself, which you said you had the background, food stamps, etc., you've been there. You've done that. You know what it's like to experience it. So therefore, somebody can see themselves through your own quote-unquote adventure through this thing.
Right. At the same time, though, I always believe, like, for example, when I started my company, I probably never would have started it if I had a thought all of the things that I had to do in order to have a successful company. It probably would have been too overwhelming. But what I did is when I resigned from the company I was working for, I resigned, and the next day I started my own business competing. And I just did every day what I needed to do first. So, you know, like the first day it was getting my stationery, getting incorporated, doing those type of things. And then the next day, whether it was working on marketing and making cold calls and whatever it was. And so I do tell people that if you want to start a business, for example, don't wait until everything is perfect and you know everything, because that's not going to happen. You're never going to know everything, and there's never going to be a time where you say, okay, everything's great and now I can do it, because there's always going to be doubts, and there's things that you're not going to know until you get into it and start moving forward. But actually, once you do it, you realize that there's sources you can go to, people that know how and can give you the knowledge, and it's not as overwhelming as it seems when you're sitting back looking at the big picture. And so I would encourage people to not get fearful about the overwhelming idea of something. And for example, one of the people I feature in my book, he started a junk collecting company with $700 and built it to a $100 million company. And so there are businesses, even in this economy, that you can start that might be a hobby or a passion. And, you know, maybe your goal isn't a $100 million company. Maybe it's just to make $100,000 or something like that a year, and it definitely is possible. There's so many ways to make money and so many businesses. And so don't get discouraged about being overwhelmed and, can I do it? A lot of times you just have to step into it and say, I can do this, and then start doing it.
By the way, Vonda, I think you're doing something absolutely brilliant here, because time and again, when the different subjects have come up on the air for many, many, many years now, so, you know, it could be finances, it could be relationships, it could be raising a child, and so on and so forth. Nobody gets that early on. You don't get it in junior high school. You don't get it in high school. You don't get most of it in college. And then you get out in the street and you find out what money means, what romance means. And I mean, this list goes on and on. And one of the biggest problems that we have in this country right now is that dropout rate in the high schools. Detroit alone has got over a 55% dropout rate. I think I've mentioned this 2-3 times a week forever now. You got 20 to 30% average dropout across the country. It's horrible. So you're offering your goal planners free to the high schools, and I think you couldn't do any better than that. Because if I can find value in something, I'll stay. But if I'm in a situation where I'm not getting any value out of it, I'm not accepted, I don't have any identity with it for education, whatever, I'm not going to be around. And I think what you're doing has got to be phenomenal.
Well, thank you. I think with students, and I know for myself, for example, I was always looking for advice and help, and I would soak it in like a sponge and listen to what people said and apply it to my life. And I loved constructive criticism, because the only way that I could improve was by someone telling me where my weaknesses were and how I could improve upon those. And I had another radio interview where the guy was a doctor, a psychologist, and he was saying most of the patients don't like getting the criticism or constructive criticism, and they won't take the advice. And I think that's really a shame, because I think all of us, whether we're young or old, can find out what are our weaknesses, how can we improve, what would make me better at this position, what would make me be considered for a promotion or to run an area, et cetera. But we have to ask, and we have to listen, and we have to be willing to make changes and to do the best that we can. And instead of looking at it as a negative, look at it as a positive, that you know, there's ways to improve, and that you've just been given that nugget of information on how, in their eyes, you can improve in order to be better in what you want to do. And I think that's a very helpful, useful thing. And the same with teens. If they would listen and have mentors, whether it's someone in business or even someone like for myself, I always admired Miss America and used her as a role model, even though I didn't know her, I just knew of her, but it was somebody that I wanted to be like.
No, by the way, we're starting to run out of time, but there's a very important point that you just came up with. Running through life, it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know that you don't know either stops you or gets you in trouble in one way, shape, or form. And there is a rule that I have lived by for many, many, many years now, and the rule is this. A good leader knows when to be a follower, and a good teacher knows when to be a student. Probably I change my hats 4 or 5 times a week, then that's what happens. Now, that said, constructive criticism, this is where the shift has to be made. Constructive criticism is not saying that you are worthless and you know nothing. That's what they hear. that's not what's being said when you're doing something constructive. You're talking about a goal that they're trying to achieve that they're not hitting the mark. So you're saying, okay, well, let's do it this way, let's do it that way. And what they're really hearing is not the better way to do the goal. What they're hearing is what a failure they are. That's what has to happen. That's where that shift has to become very prominent. And the people that are getting the criticism have got to realize that it's not about them. It's about what they're doing, and there's a better way to do it.
Right, right. And it's not even where they think that they've done a bad job. They've done a great job, but here's how you can make that leap.
Absolutely, and it's personal. Let me ask you this. Website where we can find you at?
SuccessAgainstTheOdds.com.
And can we buy the book there?
Yes, you can buy the book, and you can buy the Success Planner that will help you throughout the whole 2012 to achieve the goals and dreams that you want to achieve in the next 12 months. And then the book will be very inspirational and help encourage you to see how others started from nothing and achieved great success, and just their personal stories will inspire you.
Wonderful. Vonda White, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
To feel you near as I grow old, because I want a girl to call.
Dave Andrew is with us, struggled with excessive drinking for almost 18 years of his life before he was finally able to quit it for good. Now a sobriety and a certified life coach, he's an author, he's a public speaker. Dave helps alcoholics and families of alcoholics learn to overcome addiction and enjoy sober lives. He's the creator of the 30-Day Sobriety Solution, the multimedia program, and a contributing author to CSI, Courageous Stories of Inspiration. Let us say, Dave, I welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we're dealing with alcoholism, sobriety, etc., that is basically something that's learned, isn't it? You know, you learn to hide yourself. You learn that there's certain defenses out there. You learn if you want to feel good, you drink, you do this or you do that. Is it, and this is a question now, is it a process of relearning?
It is, and it's a process of almost unlearning, if you want to say it that way. So, you know, one thing I always share is, you know, our society puts an incredible amount of attention around drinking and around growing up, and, you know, the media is full of alcohol advertising and things like that. And so I say as a kid growing up, you identify alcohol with being an adult. You identify alcohol with being free. You start to make these associations that are really strong and powerful. You know, I always talk about that Corona commercial where the beer is I think it's Corona, but where they're sitting on the beach and the waves are, you know, rolling up and they have that beer and it's sweating. And, you know, and you think of that image, and really what you're trying to do is you're trying to unlearn some of those associations you have and learn new positive associations so you can actually learn that sobriety can actually be a wonderful, joyous, great thing and can get you to where you really want to be. And alcohol, for those at least that are problem drinkers, is actually holding you back from everything that you really want to be.
Okay, so let's add something to that. If you've learned something, you can unlearn, and then you can relearn. And I really believe that's the key to almost anything that there is. Dave, where was it when you decided that you realized that the drinking was too much? There had to come that time where, okay, it's time to quit. And what did you do about it? How did you move through that area of your life, which was not easy? It couldn't have been easy.
It wasn't easy at all. I mean, I struggled for, you know, at least the last 8 years. I tried hypnotherapy, therapy, AA, self-help, you know, you name it. I tried all kinds of things, and I had all kinds of different levels of bottoms, and that's a very common experience. I would reach one bottom, and I would make it, and I would say, okay, that's it, I'm quitting, but I really wasn't. And then I would reach another bottom, and I would say, okay, I'm quitting, but I really wasn't. So, you know, it was various phases, and then, you know, and then finally, you know, my wife had enough, I had enough. You know, she gave me an ultimatum. You know, my in-laws, one of the more embarrassing experiences, although I had plenty of them, you know, were moving the shelf and found some empty bottles of vodka underneath the shelf, and, you know, that were from a year ago, and I found many more since that time. And it was just this whole finally coming together where that was it. I was done, and I knew I had to do anything I could to get sober. And that's really when the beautiful thing happens. When you decide at all costs you have to make a choice in your life to get sober, and you get that ultimate leverage. And when you have that ultimate leverage, anything is possible in anyone's life, and that's the beauty of it. The problem is getting to that point. And sometimes you don't get a second chance. Sometimes you never get to that point because alcohol takes lives all the time, every day of the year, all over the world.
No question. Dave, what was it that caused you to be an alcoholic? Was it when you were a teenager? Was it when you were a young adult? Was it something that the alcohol took the place of that you didn't have?
You know, alcohol is always the symptom. You know, there's always something back there, behind there, that brings that out. For me, I was very much a progressive drinker. It didn't start off like all at once. It kind of evolved over the course of my life. I didn't start drinking until I was out of high school. Actually, I was in Teens Against Drugs and Alcohol in high school. I was adamant about alcohol and drugs and being against it. But I never felt like I fit in. Not an uncommon feeling for anyone that's been to high school. I never felt like I belonged. I didn't have a great group of friends in high school. I went to college, and all of a sudden I started linking drinking with friends and things like that. And I had some childhood things that were hard. Don't get me wrong. My dad and mom got divorced early on. My dad came out of the closet and was gay very early in my life, which I found out was not accepted at the time. And I found that out in some very negative ways in my life. And, you know, and my dad and mom didn't live near each other, so I didn't get to see my dad very often. So there was pain. There's no doubt. I had some painful childhood memories, but I also had very loving parents. Bottom line is I learned how to drink in a social situation, learned to create friendships and relationships through my drinking, and that kind of took me through that kind of just building, that build and build throughout college. And then by the time I got to college, my support system was gone. You know, college environment is very supportive of a drinking life. You get into the working world, it's a little different depending on the field you're in, and my world came crashing down around me, and I just couldn't quit drinking, and I didn't want to quit drinking, and I couldn't imagine a life without alcohol, and that's where things took a whole other step in the process.
Yeah, and by the way, what in all of the interviews that I've done over all of these years, and I've interviewed people as regards to being an alcoholic and so on and so forth, one of the things that I've learned, and stop me if I'm wrong because I'm not an expert in this field, but for the most part, people begin to drink because it covers what you don't want to deal with. And it's an easier way to, quote-unquote, escape it, whatever that it is, in your life, whether it's not being accepted, whether you don't feel good enough, or I mean, the list goes on here. And I think with hypnotherapy, you've got to be able to work on a problem that you have instead of the problem that you don't have. So if you're working on a problem that's really not the core of the problem, hypnosis, anything else, it's not going to work until you hit that core and you make that decision that the value for not drinking is greater than the value for drinking. That's when that decision is made, and that's when it becomes life-altering.
Yes, absolutely. And like where hypnotherapy works, and I'm not against hypnotherapy, it works amazing for some people. And, you know, my father-in-law quit smoking with one hypnotherapy session. So for some people it works. I understand the whole idea behind it. It's wonderful. Hypnotherapy gets into reprogramming the subconscious. We are subconsciously driven in so many ways, and a lot of those subconscious programming happens when we're in that 3 to 8 year old age range. And, you know, and Erickson, the famous psychologist, has really, really proved that and set the stage for that. So yeah, so hypnotherapy, you brought up a great point, and that really gets down to the subconscious piece and really starts reprogramming you where you're really broken in a lot of ways.
Okay, but let me say it this way. Let's say hypothetically that where you're broken, quote unquote, it could be your dad walked out on you, all right? And you could be working on all of these things, but unless you hit that core, whatever it is, you can't fix it. So you can fix everything else, but you still got this inner whatever it is causing the pain that you don't want to face, and you know, you cover it. The drugs, the alcohol, yep. the whatever the case may be. When you went through the hypnotherapy, did you do it in California or did you do it in Colorado?
I did it in Colorado. It was a 2-hour session.
Yeah. Okay. You know, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pragmatic, and you know, I believe there are lots of different solutions, and some things work for some people, some for others. But you're right on. Alcohol is an amazing coping mechanism. Let's look at alcohol really quick and why it works so well. This is something I share with everyone. What does alcohol do instantaneously for most people, at least early on in drinking? It removes pain and it gives you pleasure. And if you've ever studied any psychology, as a lot of people have that's listening to your show, I'm sure, you know, Sigmund Freud talks about this in the pleasure principle, that everything we do, every action we take is based on gaining pleasure and or avoiding pain. We'll do more to avoid pain than gain pleasure. Well, alcohol gives you both of those instantaneously, especially when it works. And it stops working at some point, and that's when you start reaching a bottom and start making that change. But while it's working, it can work magic, and it really allows you to forget about those problems, forget about that pain from your childhood, forget about whatever might have happen, and also add pleasure to your life right then and there. And that's the power of alcohol or any drug, and certainly drugs like meth even take that to a whole other level of pleasure.
No, absolutely. No question about it. But I was listening to you talk before, and when, you know, your wife was saying, you know, either do or don't, you know, or get off the whatever, and the value, you know, why, I don't want to lose my family. I don't want to lose my home. I don't want to lose this. And that would have been the power, that would have been that instigator. You talked about pain and pleasure.
Yes.
The fear of loss, desire for gain. Two of the motivating factors, the only motivating factors to some degree that cause a person to move forward to do whatever they're going to do or to not do. So I really believe when it comes down to it is the value for drinking became less than the value for keeping the family. And that's that motivator that all of a sudden the drinking, no matter how tough it was to be able to physically come out of it, that was the instigator that caused the transition.
Yep, you nailed it. And it's exactly what happened. So once, you know, as you said so eloquently, the pain of drinking now is so great that the pleasure you get from drinking and the release from pain just doesn't work anymore. So the equation starts changing because now you're starting to associate great pain with drinking. It's one of the reasons also I teach that willpower never works, because it's this pain pleasure conundrum that I talk about as well. Because so the pain of like my family and everything else coming crashing down, and I don't want to lose my wife, I don't want to lose my kids, I don't want to lose, you know, all of these things, all of a sudden that pain's so great to drink, I'm like, I'm quitting, that's it. And then what happens is day one, day two, day three of sobriety moves forward. If I'm not doing any internal work to really work on what the reason is I'm drinking in the first place, the pain that drove me to drinking in the first place starts to reduce. And the pleasure, and I'm starting to feel happier, and all of a sudden I move further and further from the reason why I quit drinking in the first place. It's one of the reasons AA can work really well, because you keep being reminded when you walk in these rooms and you see these people come back out of just binge drinking and things like that, and you see the pain in their face and you hear it in their voice, you remember instantly, you're like, that is why I quit. That is why I can never go back, because that's this evil little side of our brain, this drinking brain, this drinking thinking that happens when, you know, you get sober for a while, but you're not doing the inner work. And then, you know, as you get further and further away from the pain doesn't seem as real anymore. You think back to painful events in your past, they're not near as painful as they were in that moment. And that's where you get into trouble. But it's, as you said, this whole pain pleasure thing in the dynamic that exists as you go through these various phases of alcoholism.
You know what I've seen with a lot of people who are recovering alcoholics? Somebody told me once, and I realize this is true. If you're an alcoholic, you'll always be an alcoholic, but you're recovering. You're recovering. And what I have seen, and when I've talked to people, I began to realize that the tremendous amount of people that have become alcoholics were tremendously smart. They didn't know what to do with those smarts, and they scared people around them because they were too sharp. And what they did was they drank to dull it so they could have an equal balance of the people around them. And I have seen people dull themselves so they wouldn't get, you know, they wouldn't become their full potential because they didn't want to scare people away who were accepting them.
And I see that as well. I also see another side to that, or another trait of that, is simply that the addictive personality is very gung-ho and very energetic and very, like, they dive into things and they go all in, and it's all or nothing. It's a very common scenario I work with everyone, including myself, that I coach. You know, it's like, it's either I want to do everything and I want to go all in or nothing. And so the problem is that the alcoholic tendency is the alcohol allows them to stop, allows them to take a break and take a deep breath. So it's these people that are high achievers, and that's why high achieving alcoholics are very common, that go, and they can't stay at home and relax without having a drink because they won't allow themselves. But it's that alcohol and that link they brought that says, okay, now I can relax, now I can drink, now I can mellow out, because I see the exact same thing you're talking about, and a lot of it to me comes back to that addictive personality of that just, you know, you'd go all in with things. But yeah, I mean great point, obviously.
Sure, and like with ADHD, there was somebody that said a long time ago that in the classroom, that if they took those kids that they knew that had ADHD, and instead of sitting them in a seat, they had them at a desk where they could stand up and function, a lot of the things that happened wouldn't happen. And I really believe that when you're dealing with alcoholism, ADHD, anything like that, if you begin to realize what it is and what's causing that to happen to that person, if you could adjust their lifestyle to it, adjust yep. their learning processes to it, then all of a sudden the world turns completely around for them.
On the same topic, which is great, 60 Minutes, just a couple, last week or 2 weeks ago, I believe, showed that the child prodigy that was a math genius. And all through his early years, up till the age 3, I believe, they said they had diagnosed him with severe autism and all kinds of things. And what they realized was they were not providing him with the right stimulation. So they started providing him with, you know, all this advanced math and all of this, training, and he started thriving. And you saw him in this interview, and he was, you know, he sounded completely normal, looked normal. I mean, he looked, you know, he's very intelligent, and it was, once again, it's like you said, customizing your approach based on the personality type. And that gets into a whole other topic, right? But, you know, based on personality type, based on strength and weaknesses, things like that. And it's a great conversation, and it's obviously something very important to do when you're trying to overcome any kind of debilitating behavior, whether it's, you know, addictive drinking and other things, or whether it's, other issues.
When I was in the fifth or sixth grade, they were going to advance me a grade because all of the information came to me too fast, and it came back out of me too fast. It was real easy for me, but they couldn't keep me quiet, so I became a talk show host, and then they kept me back. But the important thing was this: when I was taking tests, I would end up in high school, in junior high school, I was getting C's and D's all the time. I could not pass a test. Didn't matter what the information was. I got it. I learned very quickly. So when I got out of high school, I was in the service. They gave me my first pair of glasses. Turned out I was dyslexic. Now, had I not found that out, life might have been completely different for me. So you're right. It's adjusting to whatever it is, and you've got to know what you're dealing with so you can work with it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well said.
Okay. We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at, buy the book, get more information, and if we have the problem,
yep.
contact you so we can get this thing fixed?
Yeah, so The Sobriety Solution, thesobrietysolution.com, or to search for Dave Andrews Sobriety Solution, you'll find me right away in the top. So yeah, on the website I have all kinds of great free resources. One of the things that I'm getting a lot of rave reviews right now is I offer a 3 steps to sobriety video program, completely free, no cost, 3 videos, some great PDFs and reports you get. And so that's something you can get just to get a feel for my content, but also just come to the website. You can get on my list and you can check other things out. And then of course the 30-day sobriety solution is my flagship product. And, you know, I've been lucky enough and, honored enough to see many, many lives change dramatically, people that have failed in rehab and failed in AA and failed in all kinds of different ways in getting sober, but my program ended up being a great fit for them. So, and then I offer sobriety coaching and life coaching. So, yeah, you can find me there. The book is not out yet. It should be out the end of this quarter, I believe, so that'll be posted on the website when you're there. But that's how you can find me, and a little more information if you're looking, or if you know if a loved one or friend is looking for help.
And by the way, let me, Dave Andrews, let me finish it with this. That when you really come down to it, your alcoholism was the best thing that ever happened, not only to you, but to those people 100 years from now when they take the program and it saves a life or turns a life around. So I like what you do, and I think you're doing great. Go out there and get them.
Thanks, Michael. I really appreciate your time, and you have a great rest of your week.
Take care, Dave. Good night.
Bye.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone, well, that's all, well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night, well, that's all, well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore.
Dr. Heidi Horsley with us and Dr. Gloria Horsley with us. They are the co-authors of Open to Hope, Inspirational Stories of Healing, after loss. They are a mother and daughter team. They're internationally recognized grief experts. They are the founders of the Open to Hope Foundation and host a weekly internet radio show, The Open to Hope Show. And Dr. Gloria serves as the National Advisory Board on the Compassionate Friends and writes a monthly blog for Maria Shriver. Dr. Heidi is an adjunct professor at the University of Columbia University and serves as the National Board of Directors for the Compassionate Friends and on the Advisory Board for the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors of Military Loss. Heidi, Gloria, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. I'm Mom. Gloria.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks a lot.
Hi, Mom and daughter. How are you?
Good.
By the way, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Oh, they're great. And please don't ask me to say Columbia University three times. I'll fall all over myself. But which, yeah. All right, let's talk this way. Let's start out. Gloria, let's start out with you.
All right. Well,
in all of your experience, let's define what, not so much loss, but what is grief? What do you find that is? Is there a common overarching theme for all the patients that you've worked with that if they were to define grief after they've worked with you, what would they say it was? How would they define it?
Well, it's really the connection, the heart connection and the physical connection with those people who are no longer in our lives. I mean, of course, there's other grief for jobs and things that happen in our lives that we would like back. Grief is something that we have lost and that we long for and trying to get it back in our life in the beginning and then learning to live with it and to kind of have a new life.
Okay, and Heidi, let me throw this over to you. Is grief a process?
It absolutely is a process, Michael, and grief also comes in waves. It doesn't come in nice, neat stages like we've been led to believe in the past. It does come in waves, and sometimes we may be doing fine, and then an anniversary reaction may happen or a bad day may happen, and it puts us right back into a really bad place. So it does come in waves, and it is a process, and it's a lot longer process than we've ever been led to believe.
Now, and by the way, when we deal with grief, and better yet, when we deal with loss, there is no way to prepare for loss. We can get the strategy to get there, but once it happens, and there's nothing that you can do about it. But is there a process, and Gloria, let me ask you this, you know, is there a process with grief? Is there first confusion, depression, anger, grief, whatever? Is there stages that some through that you can almost put your finger on it and say, this is what's going to happen, and this is what we'll deal with during that time period?
I think there are a lot of commonalities connected with it. One of the, for a while with the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and by the way, in our book, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross Foundation writes the foreword, but Elizabeth is dead, but she was such a pioneer and talked about, you know, everyone knows the stages of anger, denial, depression, acceptance. And she came up with those stages, and people kind of caught on with them. But now we realize that not everyone goes through those stages at the same rate. Some people don't have the same response. So it depends on your individual personality. But I think there are some things that you can plan on in the beginning. Well, you can't plan on it. You just do it. When my son was killed in 1983, he was 17, he was killed in an automobile accident, I was teaching at the University of Rochester Medical Center. I was the psychiatric nursing consultant to the entire surgical service. I had worked with many people who had lost children and family members, and at the time I said, I know some information that I think could help you, but I have never had this happen. And, well, it happened to me the next week. And it was such a physical experience as well as an emotional one. I saw myself going through the stages that I'd read about and studied about, you know, the physical too, the sighing, respirations, that early shock when you're frozen. So there is that. And then moving on to what I call the first of it is restoration, where you want that person back. And, you know, you go to sleep and you wake up and you think they're there and you really want them back. And then when you get kind of thought out of that stage and realize, you know, that the bed is going to be empty and it isn't a dream, then you move into reconciliation, which is people, you're sitting there trying to figure out why this happened. You know, how did it happen? And there are all the emotional responses connected with that. But you know what? If that person walked in the room, you'd be fine. So one of the things people don't realize is that it's a thought process that's driving this whole the grief thing, too. We're thinking this, so we want him back. We want it restored. Then we want to find out who did it, why, how did it happen. We don't want it to happen again. Was it the doctor's fault? Was it my fault? You know, there's a lot of blame and guilt and anger going on there. And eventually, if people can get to the next stage or next thought process where it's reality, where you say, it is what it is. They are gone. They are going to be gone. They're not coming back. And it doesn't help to feel like I'm going to get people. The reality is that they are dead, and how do we know they should be dead? Because they are. That's a harsh thing. But when you get to that point, then you can move into reunion. And when I call it reunion, I say that's at the point where you come to terms with who you are without that person in your life physically, but then they are always with you in your heart. I mean, we like to say closures are for bank accounts, not love accounts.
Sure. Yeah, no question about it. Heidi, let me ask you this. When your brother died, were you a doctor yet?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I was 20 years old, and when he died, it completely turned my life upside down. It put everything I ever knew into question. He was my younger brother. I assumed we were going to be parallel travelers in life together, and I assumed eventually we'd grow old together and I'd die before him. At that point, not only did I not know how I was going to survive, I had no idea if I even wanted to. And, you know, through that journey and through all those waves of grief, eventually when I came out on the other side of it, and it is a journey, I decided I was going to go into the field of grief and loss and help others define hope again. Because early on, I honestly didn't believe there was any hope, and I thought it was ridiculous to even think that there ever would be. And we really are here with our message that there is hope again. And if you've lost hope, that's a normal reaction. Please lean on ours, because we've been there and made it. And we really believe that our listeners can too, and that your listeners can.
But it's our. It's always our. Because when you really come down to it, that when somebody loses someone, and there is hope. Hope, I think that's the most powerful word that you can use. Hope means something to look forward to, something to anticipate. It's not giving them something that they can't wrap their arms around and actually achieve as a goal, quote unquote. But I would venture to guess that hope has to come in different stages, from that very beginning stage when it does happen, nothing's going to work and nothing matters. So there's got to be that period of time when the spark of hope can be recognized.
Yeah.
That's why we called, Mom, I was just going to say about the way that we named the foundation. That's why we called it the Open to Hope Foundation, because we wanted people to realize we're not telling you to have hope. We're just saying be open to the possibility and the idea of just a little glimmer of hope in your life. I'm sorry, Mom, did you want to take it from there?
No, go ahead. I was just going to say one of the things that when we speak to people who are really feeling pretty hopeless, we suggested then that they think about gratitude, starting out taking care of yourself. And gratitude, when you've had a loss, is being grateful that you can open your eyes in the morning, that you can put your foot out of the bed, that you can, you know, get a sock on, that you can match your shoes. You know, be grateful that you can do that to start with. Start finding the little tiny things, because those are the things that are going to give you hope that you will move on.
See, what I'm hearing also,
and it is really hard at the beginning to have that gratitude. I mean, I remember having a difficult time, and eventually I moved into the place where I was grateful that I had Scott in my life for 17 years.
See, and the two of you, and especially Heidi also, for what I'm hearing, you're becoming his legacy. Heidi, you wouldn't probably be who you are doing what you do and helping the people that you help had it not happened to your brother. I mean, I'm sorry that happened to him. But in 100 years from now, somebody who you helped, who helped somebody else, and who could pick up the book and get the same valuable information from, so there is something that came out of it.
Absolutely. And for so many people,
yeah.
We have 125 people writing for our book on Open to Hope, and it's about what they've gone on and done. I mean, just the things that people like Candy Leitner, who started Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and, you know, people have just gone on. Michelle Neff Hernandez has started a whole organization for widows, and it's just amazing what people have done, and they're surprised, you know, that they have gone on and done these kind of things and found a mission and a meaning.
No question about it.
Like my mom said, that's what our book is about. Not only our story, but 100 other stories in the book. And like you said, Michael, I would have never, ever been a psychologist had my brother not died. I had no intention of doing it. I honestly feel that this is my calling. It's not something I chose, because sometimes when we get derailed in life and we have great adversity, out of that comes our calling. So, yes, absolutely. I am here today to give others hope and to be a voice for everybody out there right now that's grieving and in a bad place and doesn't have a voice.
And so also, I want to say for the folks out there, sorry, Michael, for the folks out there that are saying, you know what I hate, Michael? I hate when people say to me, you never get over it, do you? I mean, I can't tell you how many times people say that.
Yeah, but you know what?
But, Mom, the reality is you don't get over the person, you don't get over the person, nor would you want to, but you get over the pain. And that's what my mom and I are kind of here to say. You get over the pain. And our book is a resource book about 100 people, you know, that have been there and gotten through the pain.
But when you come down to it, I think the two most important words that the two of you work with is hope and possibility, because that's something mm-hmm. that's palatable to most people. If you had a book that was all about freedom and you got on the air and you said, buy my book, you'll be free forever. Yeah, sure, right. But if you talked about the potential of freedom and by using, you know, the certain benefits that you would offer, that somebody could put their foot on the path of the possibility of freedom, now all of a sudden you got something that's workable. Hope, obviously something to look forward to, and possibility is a very strong word, because choices open the doorway to possibility, and as long as there's something there, once they get past the worst part, then they've got something to work with.
Absolutely. And, you know, and our website, we have a huge multimedia platform website, and we ask people out there that are listening to your show, if you have had an experience with grief, loss, hope, and healing, and if you like to write, come and join us. Come and be a writer for the Open to Hope Foundation. So we even give people
Absolutely.
That possibility.
We
they can write on our forums, but they can also write articles for us.
We'd love to hear your voice, and I'm sorry, Michael.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, like my mom said, we want to hear the voices out there. We are a 24/7 resource, and we're free. We have 6 years of downloaded radio shows you can listen to. We have over 3,000 articles. We have 100 YouTubes, all devoted to finding hope after loss. And all you need to do is go to our website, opentohope.com, and get free resources 24/7, because all of you out there that have been through a loss know that oftentimes the worst part of the day is in the middle of the night when there's nobody around, your therapist is gone, whoever's in your life, people are asleep, and you are all alone. And you can get on the internet, and we're there for you. We are a virtual 24/7 community that's there to support you and to lead you and to hold your hand and to give you hope until you found your own.
Go ahead. Your microphone. Yeah. I'll jump in a minute. Go ahead.
One of the things I like most about the Open to Hope and the internet is that the fact that you may be fine for a week, and then you may have an anniversary reaction. Maybe it's the year since your family member died or whatever, and you cannot connect with the internet, and then you can come on. And it's there, all this information, all these articles. And also, Michael, you were saying people grieve differently, and they really
sure.
do. And that's why I love having mm-hmm. 350 people write for us and 3,000 articles, because you can find somebody who has more of a voice like you do and is in the process of where you are. So it's just a really rich platform.
Oh, sure. It's got to be
it is, and the other thing that we always say is, you know, even though the losses in our lives may define us, they do not destroy us. And like my mom said, we are out there, and we don't want to minimize your loss. We just want to be there to support you through this time in your life.
And by the way, there is another avenue here that as you were talking, which I thought about. You don't have to lose anybody to go through the grief. So the processes that you're talking about could come from a divorce, could come from any number of mm-hmm. things whereby somebody has lost somebody. But, let's take it where it's at. If somebody gets divorced, there is in and of itself in a way that there is a death there. But the process is the process, and the possibility is there. And you don't have to lose anybody through death to be able to take advantage of what the two of you are offering.
Yeah, it is the same type of process, no question. And I'll tell you another thing. I have books. People come up to me to buy these books or send for them, and they say, Gloria, I don't want you to sign it. And I'm like, oh, okay. They say, because I'm giving it to a neighbor. I've got some people I want. This isn't really for me. And I will tell you, people ought to have 10 of these sitting in their house, because it is so devastating when you have a family member die or a kid who dies in your town or whatever, and you can drop one of these books off at their house with just, I'm sorry about your loss, and I thought this might be helpful.
And the
other thing about the book, Mom, is it's not a cover-to-cover book. It's a kind of a coffee table book where you pick it up, and it's only two pages of somebody's story. And then the next one is two more pages, so you can just read it very quickly. And, you know, when we're grieving, we don't want a dense, difficult 300-page read. So this is that kind of book. It really is a resource.
Yeah, but what about taking a look at it in a different light also? I'm listening very closely to the two of you talk. What about the book before anything happens? Wouldn't it be interesting if in one way, shape, or form, you could prepare yourself? That doesn't mean that when it happens, it's going to be easy for you. No, it's not. It's going to be very hard. But at least there is the hope and the possibility prior to it happening.
Yeah, that is true. It's particularly if sometimes we're going to be speaking at hospice in the spring, mm-hmm. The National Hospice in Florida. And what a great book for families to have there and to glance through if they're not ready, you know, to read it, just to even read the headings and to think about this process and to think that there is going to be somebody there who does care and a community.
Oh, by the way, I wouldn't call it...
And people there that have been there.
Oh, we're starting to run out of time, but I wouldn't call it a book. I would find another name for it, because it's not. It's a living, alive thing. All right, can we get your website one more time, and where to buy the book, and a little more where we can find you and follow you?
Okay. OpenToHope.com is our website, and you can listen to our radio shows from there. You can also listen to our radio shows on Voice America, and we're on podcast. You can find us on podcasting. I write, as you said, for the Maria Shriver blog, and you can also, where else, Heidi? We're on Amazon, and you can buy the book also off of our site, and we do a lot of speaking. We're very happy to come around and speak to different organizations, and I don't know, Heidi, what have you
got? And if you Google our names, you'll find us, as well as the hundreds of authors that write for us. So please, like we said, our biggest message out there is, if you've lost hope, please lean on ours. You are not alone. We've been there and made it, and you can too.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you both for joining us tonight. I love what you do. Go out and do more.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Michael. We appreciate you having us on.
We do, yeah. And I hope everybody out there will tell everyone about the foundation.
Absolutely.
You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Richard Merrill Kahn with us, author of Winning Against Foreclosure. Winning Against Foreclosure. He's recognized as America's leading pioneer in mortgage-backed securitization auditing. Richard founded Forensic Professionals Group in 2008, and it was to provide borrowers and their legal advisors with indisputable facts backed by documentation, helping hundreds of people to beat banks in foreclosure cases. He has more than 30 years' experience in mortgage analysis, residential and commercial real estate, mortgage-backed securities, and lending, financing, and extended experience as an expert witness in court. Richard, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I have to say that I really enjoyed the music you were playing as I was waiting.
Oh, thank you. It's great stuff. Gets you in the mood anyway. Richard, let me ask you this. Wait, there's so much confusion about foreclosure. Let's go all the way back to where it started. And before we start that, I have talked to person after person after person. I've interviewed people who ran into problems because of the economy, had no money to pay the mortgage. Richard, it went on for a year, 18 months, 2 years. They would call different banks. They would call different lending agencies. Oh, the papers would be sold from one to the other, and nobody knew who owned it. And on top of that, the people who owned it didn't know who to come after to foreclose in the first place. Where did this confusion start?
Well, that's called the dual track, and that is a very measured, pointed event, and that they want to, promulgate so that they keep people off guard while they move towards foreclosure. They can't foreclose on millions of homes at once. No. We ended up in this mess as a result of, and actually it happened in November of 1999, the outgoing President Clinton, his Republican Congress repealed the Banking Act of 1933, which was created by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our only four-term president, in order to block the investment banks and the commercial banks from getting together and doing just this type of thing that they did back then now.
Okay, now, but we did it. We got involved in it, and the blame, people have been pointing fingers for, a good few years now. But where was it? Was it, I don't know if it was Wall Street or maybe it was with the mortgage-backed securities. But in the end result, very simply, a bank would package up a few mortgages, and then they'd sell it off, and the package would be packaged with another one, and then they would sell it off. And by the time that you had the end result package, that billion-dollar package, quote-unquote, was only worth $100,000. And that's when it fell apart. That's where the problem started. I exaggerated.
You have a lot of listeners out there who are facing foreclosure and feeling that they're deadbeats, that they're going to be, that they're victims. When in fact, the mortgage companies who got together with the commercial and investment banks and put these deals together have skewered them, hung them. Those mortgages were completely paid off by investors. Mortgage-backed securitization is the act of taking hundreds, or in these cases, mostly thousands of loans, one to about 4,000, pooling them together and then selling them, securitizing, changing them, making them securitized so that they would trade as securities and people would buy them. And there's $8 trillion of underlying mortgages, and there were about $62 trillion of these trumped up trades that occurred as commodities.
Yeah, and when you come down to it, what was the real value? Well, you know, the dollar value. I'm not looking for a number, but it was nowhere near the numbers you just said.
Well, $62 trillion is about eight times the global global national product. Certainly, there's not enough underlying mortgage security behind that. The entire scheme was built on predatory lending programs. If you were going to know that you could issue loans that were going to recast and convert to loans that would create much higher payments in default, wouldn't it be sweet if you were able to issue these loans and then some subsidiaries down the road would be able to come in and foreclose on those loans because nobody could identify the real purchaser?
Yeah. No, interesting point. And one of the things that I'm looking at, that I've got your press release in front of me. I'm not an expert at this, but I've done enough interviews, et cetera, with this. There's something that you talk about called a wrongful foreclosure. Have there been people out there that have lost their homes that shouldn't have?
Tens of thousands. I had the privilege of working with attorney generals, their offices, law firms that are pursuing those type of cases. Tens of thousands of loans, 18,000 here, 10,000 there, have been halted in foreclosure because of the discovery of fabricated, questionable, false documentation presented to foreclose. What you've got is a loan servicer, like a repo man, who knows, because his ears are wiggling, that the owner doesn't exist, but that there's a borrower out there. So he swoops in, he takes his repo men that are wearing different, you know, mechanics clothes at one time, puts a white shirt and a tie on them, puts a black hat on them, puts a label on them. He says, okay, now you're going to be MERS. Now you're going to be a servicer. Now you're going to be this one. They all sign different documents, swear to it, submit it in court, present it to court as if it's a real, live, you know, bona fide transaction. The court orders foreclosure. The repo man gets the home, sells it at dirt because anything is profit, completely undermines our real estate values, steals the home away from the borrower, never permitted them a chance to really negotiate a loan modification. And so all of these millions of people out there are facing foreclosure, and they don't really know that they have an outlet that they can battle this and win in court.
Now, by the way, one other thing, a very important term here, and I'm going to tie this into it, and it's yours, information versus evidence, differentiating between pretenders and the real thing. That's a lot of what you just talked about, isn't it?
You know, I'm confronted all of the time with a bunch of pretenders. I run an academy that teaches people who want to work in the business to come in and learn the skills to become investigators and then to have the support of expertise to apply their trade. One of the most prevalent problems that we have is companies that go ahead and certify or put out pretender auditors who create fabricated rules of affidavits of experience based upon puffery, and when it comes to actually testifying, which is where it comes down to in every case, or at least in the cases that don't settle, they just fold upon the intense opposing counsel cross-examination. So if you don't have evidence, hardcore facts, undisputable because due to their nature, that are material and genuine to the issues under the rules, federal rules of civil procedure of federal courts and state courts. I testify in all courts. And if you don't meet those criteria in the evidence you're providing the attorney or the pro se litigant, what happens is upon challenging of cross-examination, the evidence is thrown out.
Okay, but let's back something up for a minute, okay? Realistically, on a practical level, is there a statute of limitations once the house has been foreclosed on, once it's all said and done, is there a time frame? Is there a particular time limit that you can go back and say this wasn't right?
You know, we're not lawyers. And so we're doing our job, just like an appraiser doesn't, you know, ply the real estate trade. The issue is this. To my knowledge, there's no statute of limitations against fraud. In an already foreclosed upon situation, we're called to a higher level of reporting, investigation, and results called misrepresentation of intrinsic or extrinsic form. Intrinsic means having to do with the documentation or case. Extrinsic with having to do with preventing people involved from finding out the real deal.
Okay, well, all right, let me ask you a practical question now. Well, let me hold you up because I don't want to go too fast with this. Let me ask you a practical question. This is what I'm hearing, and then Richard, stop me if I'm wrong here. Let's say, and this did not happen to me, but let's say I lost a home 3.5 years ago, and it fell under the auspices of everything that you're talking about. There was fraud in the inducement. There were people who had no idea what they were doing, and the defense against it, not the defense, but the litigation against it was so strong, it would scare those that weren't strong enough to handle it. Now, I come to you, and I say, these were the facts. Can you build a case for me to go back and say, you better take another look at it? Just a question.
You know, in the reality, that's a great question. In the reality of foreclosure, you have the predominant people, the ones who are bleeding in front of your triage on carts waiting for you to come in, the few, to take them like the old MASH movies.
Yeah.
Those are really the ones that we try to pay special attention to, because those are whom the attorneys, who are mostly my clients, and I have 500 of them nationwide, are coming in and saying, look, these people are losing it, or they just lost it a few months ago or last year. I want to help them. If they've lost their home years ago, you know, you have to take a look at it on an individual case. It may not be worth it, although they can win, but what is it that they're going to win? The object of the exercise is either to take quiet title to your home, go back and say, you know what, nobody is going to come forth and take this home. The loan servicer won it. The loan servicer didn't have any rights to it. They misrepresented it, and I'm telling you that they stole it away from me. And so I now want to go for quiet title, which means that if nobody comes forward and steps forward with a note in one hand and a mortgage in the other and shows me a bank statement, how they paid for it, then I'm going to get the house after a certain amount of time from a judge. Well, okay, if it's worth it, then they can pursue that. However, the ones who are bleeding right now, they have, you know, a more, what you might call current need.
Sure.
The answer to your question, Michael, which is a great question, and I'll be very brief, is that, yes, you can go back and get the old ones that foreclosed, but there's millions of foreclosures right now facing people.
Okay, but let's talk for the moment, you know, for the moment, and then when you said it may not be worth it. I know somebody in particular, she had a condo that was valued about $500,000 right around the time that it was foreclosed on. It took the 2-3 years, the 2.5 years, whatever it was, before they actually did it. And she got to a point where when the market crashed, that same $500,000 condo, if you looked at fair market value, would only have been about 300 and some odd thousand. And I think her condo is still sitting out there somewhere, hasn't been sold yet. So in essence, when you come down to it, is it even worth it after a period of time if you're not so so into it where the thing is upside down and you're going to lose $200,000 if you get your house back?
You know, the issue is this, and it's hard to understand. Somebody, you're sitting there with a mortgage. Somebody could pay that mortgage off. It could be an investor. It could be a winner of a lottery. It could be a parent. It could be a benefactor. It could be anybody. If they pay off that mortgage, that note that was used to foreclose upon, and an entity takes that note and brings it before a court and says, look, it wasn't paid. I'm taking it in foreclosure. Then the fact that it was paid upon but did not inure to the benefit of the borrower, owner of the property, means somebody else took it away when it really should have gone to the borrower.
No, and I hear you loud and clear. Now, we're starting to run out of time, but Richard, let me ask you this question. Winning against foreclosure, a strategic guide. All right. I pick the book up. It gives me the strategy. But if I need to go beyond the book, do I get a consultation with you? How does this work?
You know, it seems everybody on the planet, it seems that I don't do any referrals to attorneys, but it seems everybody on the planet is reaching out to me as an expert, to my website. May I mention it?
Sure, please. Yes.
FPG-USA.com. Forensic Professionals Group-USA. FPG-USA.com. I'm nationally recognized. I'm a big player in this game. There are a lot of people who hide behind false names because they have this self-imposed imaginary feeling that lenders are going to attack them. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of uneducated people leading the blind, like that old Richard Pryor movie.
Yeah.
No, here, you know, you come to us, you have litigation, you have audits, you have expert witnesses, you have hard evidence, you have the real experts to go to. Every case is really different. You need to be able to detect robo-signers, falsity, false documentation, things, misrepresentation presented to court. You need to know the difference between information versus evidence. You need to differentiate between pretenders and the real thing. You need to know somebody who knows how to deal out the weapons and attack dog, which is us, and how to affect assistance in litigation and mediation and settlement support so that people facing foreclosure now are undermined. Now the people wanting to foreclose say, hey, wait a minute, we're going to be exposed. Okay, with this one case, we'll make a good long-term solution. We'll lower the principal. We'll lower the payment. We'll extend the term. We'll let this guy get off. We'll go take somebody else's property. This one's too dangerous for us.
No, and by the way, I hear you loud and clear. And then the other side of that, and I'm going to have you come back on because there's too much that we need to really talk about here. But the other side of this, too, is the cost for starting the litigation to get yourself back to balance again. And with that, Richard, one more time, please, slowly with your website. If somebody misses it, it's always on my website. They can see it. Go ahead, please, your website.
F like Foxtrot, P like Papa, G like Golf, dash, which is the minus sign, USA.com.
Hey, Richard, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You know what, Michael? It's quite an honor as a person in my stature to be interviewed by you and to reach out to your audience of constituents. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
Hey, thank you so much. Good night.
Good night to you.
Your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
I can only give you love that lasts forever. And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking.
Dr. Janice Denger with us, PhD. She's the author of The Perfect Formula Diet, How to Lose Weight and Get Healthy. New with six kinds of whole foods, once a food and weight-obsessed teenager, over 1,000 scientific studies to formulate this eating plan. She's done it. She has a PhD in human development and aging from the University of California, San Francisco, one of the country's leading health science campuses, and an MBA from the University of California, Berkeley. She's worked in a variety of positions in the healthcare field, leading innovative health insurance, alternative medicine, and wellness projects for large and mid-sized employers. And let us say hi. Welcome to the show, Janice.
Hi, Michael. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we hear so much about the different kind of foods. When we're talking about foods, what is a whole food?
Okay, a whole food is something you can make in your kitchen. So first off, it starts out being an edible plant, but it doesn't have to be raw. You can cook it. It would include things like vegetables, fruits, beans, potatoes, nuts, seeds, whole grains, herbs, spices. Those would be the leading kinds of whole foods.
You know, one of the biggest problems, Janice, that I think people have today, they get overweight and they listen to somebody and they go on this diet and then it doesn't work. So they go on to another diet and that doesn't work. And then they find something else and that doesn't work. And they're back to square one and usually frustrated about the whole thing. What have you found in your experience is the missing link? What is that certain something that they haven't been getting that they should, that could cause that weight reduction, that weight loss?
Well, the reason people don't succeed on a lot of these diets, there's a couple reasons. One is they might be eating the wrong foods, which almost always happens. And animal foods are not going to satisfy them because people are this awesome composition of like 100 trillion cells. And your body wants to be healthy. You have to work with your body. If you work with your body and you're trying to defy the basic laws of biology and physics and chemistry, that's not going to work. So it's really important to understand, you know, how your body works and to make sure you're working with it. And things like portion control actually work against your body because your body's telling you it's hungry, right? So when people go on diets that rely on so-called high protein, that doesn't work because, you know, they're not getting what they need in terms of nutrients. And when they go on the portion control, they're not getting what they need in terms of nutrients. But they're also, you know, just trying to trick their stomach because your stomach is about a liter, which is a little bigger than a quart, say about 33 ounces. And with portion control, you're just eating 4 to 8 ounces of food. So you're trying to trick the stomach that was made by nature to hold 33 ounces of food into being happy with 8 ounces of food. And it's not going to happen. I mean, you just cannot lose weight by starving yourself in the long run because you have to eat. It's just a biological imperative, and nobody can hold out against that drive to eat when they're hungry for a very long time.
No. And Janice, by the way, I'm not a clinician, but the one thing that I have learned over the years of doing interviews and so on and so forth is that your body and your brain is an electrochemical factory, you know, and you've got these pathways through the body. Now, if you're not eating the right thing, and foods all turn into chemical anyway, if you're not eating the right thing, that particular food that's supposed to go to a particular part of your body to make it function is not going to happen. There's going to be a disconnect. So realistically, when you eat the right foods, it affects your immune system in the right way, and that connection is made, and the energy is flowing, and things work. And I think, you know, what you said early on, it's the what we eat and not how much we eat that's going to make or break that weight control.
That's exactly, very well said. I mean, you have to satisfy your appetite and you have to satisfy your nutrient sensors, your calorie receptors, your stomach stretch receptors. And when you eat whole plant foods, if you fill your stomach with a balanced blend of the kind of whole plant foods I mentioned, you would have just eaten about 500 calories. Your stomach would be full from top to bottom. You'd have all the phytonutrients and nutrients you need, which is, I think, what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're just going to feel good. You're going to have a lot more energy. You're probably going to be reversing chronic illness like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, you know, depression, headaches, arthritis, which are basically foodborne illnesses.
Now, by the way, if I am an absolute novice at this, you know, and I hear words like, you know, superfoods and so on and so forth, what do I do? How do I put my foot on the path of getting what I need to get? Because when I pick the book up, what's the book going to give me that I don't have? And where's that book going to take me? Your book, where's it going to take me to get the end result I'm looking for?
It's going to take you to an understanding of exactly which whole foods to eat and in what proportions. So what you're going to learn is, you know, which kinds of whole foods you need to eat and how much of each relative to the other. There's not an absolute total number of, you know, bites of food you can eat or calories of food you can eat, because you're going to pay attention to your body and your body's going to tell you that. But what you want to eat is a balanced blend of fruits, vegetables, beans, potatoes, whole grains, and then small amounts of nuts and seeds. And the book tells you exactly how to do that. And also for people that are interested, and not everybody's interested in, you know, delving into the details, and that's fine, but for people that are, it's going to tell you why it works. It's going to tell you exactly why it works, exactly why it's going to reverse chronic disease. It's going to give you insight into a lot of very dangerous food myths that are very prevalent out there. So, you know, there's a lot of things that people can learn from this book.
Okay. Now, by the way, when you deal with everything that you're talking about, all of us are so very different. I mean, we have a body, we have a brain, we have an immune system, and so on and so forth. But we're all a different degree and combination of all of these things, and I think that's what's critical. You know, a lot of the diets and a lot of the foods that we eat today they're not in sync with the way the body operates. And what you might eat and what I might eat can have a completely different effect on us. So what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, when you get into the whole foods and some of the foods that you talked about, that's a good middle-of-the-road balance that will allow you to become healthy, and it won't throw you off track.
Right, exactly. And in terms of, you know, genetic differences, those get oversold. I mean, if you look at species in nature, and the philosophy of the book is your body is perfectly designed by nature, so you need to, you know, you can even look at wild animals and how they're perfectly designed by nature. And within any one species, you'll notice all the animals eat about the same thing. So if you're looking, for example, at rabbits, they're all eating greens and other plants. You don't find some rabbits eat bugs and some eat meat and some eat plants. And, you know, if you look at mountain lions, they all eat deer or, you know, whatever they can find to kill. They, you know, it's not like some eat deer and some eat pine bark. So
sure,
with any species, the way nature designed it, all the individuals within that species, even though there are very clear genetic differences between, you know, different specific individuals, are all going to eat about the same food. And the same is true of people. Form follows function, which means if you look at our bodies, you can tell what we're designed to eat. And humans
sure
have every mark of being herbivores. Therefore, you know, regardless of genetic differences, and there's a lot of evidence I could talk to you about. I know we probably don't have much time about, you know, genetic differences tend to get way overblown and really, you know, unless somebody has a clear, you know, diagnosed genetic defect, specific disease, are going to be eating pretty much the same diet.
Yeah, by the way, I'm looking at something that that in your press release, you're saying that fish is not necessarily healthy. You know, we hear it constantly. We're bombarded with this message, fish is good, fish is healthy. And from what you're saying, it's not.
No, fish isn't healthy, and there's a lot of reasons for it. One thing, it's full of mercury, and all fish have mercury. Fish are also the most polluted food in terms of being full of persistent organic pollutants, which are very dangerous chemicals that accumulate in the fat of animals. So they accumulate in the fat of all animals, whether it's cows or pigs or chickens or turkeys, but they accumulate the most in fish. And these are things like DDTs and solvents and, you know, just flame retardants and things like that are most concentrated in fish. Fish also have parasites, which are little tiny worms. So it's actually people, if they're eating sushi, they think they're eating fresh fish, but if they are, they're in big trouble because they could end up with a huge fish tapeworm. Actually, sushi has to be deep frozen, and I don't mean in a home freezer, but an industrial freezer at very low temperatures for extended periods of time to kill these parasites. Or alternately, if the fish isn't frozen, it can, of course, be cooked, and if it's cooked long enough and at high enough temperatures, it will kill the parasites. But the interesting thing is, Michael, when I posted a blog about this, about, you know, fish contain worm larvae and quite a number of reasons, I believe there were 10 overall, why eating fish is not healthy, I had quite a number of people get back to me and say, oh, they had that experience where they actually cut into a piece of fish and they saw the little tiny worm larvae kind of wiggling around. And I published one of those stories on my blog.
Yeah, wait, there goes dinner tonight. Yeah.
Even if the worm larvae are killed, Michael, I mean, here's the thing, are they appetizing? I mean, if they're dead, they're not going to affect you, so you're safe from the tapeworms and all the other parasites, because there's quite a number of kinds. But honestly, you're eating then dead worms rather than live worms. It's hard for me to see why that's appetizing.
You just killed my desire for any fish from this point forward. But in all seriousness, the Whole Foods Diet book, that's where the key is. And it's a path to health and weight loss. Now, we're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you and buy the book?
Absolutely. The website is perfectformuladiet.com. Again, all one word, perfectformuladiet.com. If people want to get a lot of information, they can just go to the blog section. There's about 100 blogs now, and most are like little mini chapters that relate to the book. They're not from the book, but they relate to topics in the book. There's a lot of success stories. You know, people I've interviewed that have lost, you know, 30, 50, 100-plus pounds on whole food plant-based diets. There's some specific instructions about what to eat. And then there's a number of other resources. There's referrals to cookbooks. There's a survey I did. And there's just a lot of really good substantive information on that site that people can benefit from.
Wonderful. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight and so much for fish from now on. Okay. Hey, thank you again for this.
Janice, you're welcome. Tonight.
Okay.
Good to be here. Bye.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Cheers and laughter.